Hello and welcome. This is Karen Bodakaitis, and you're listening to How She Really Does It on KDRT 95.7 FM. I believe that we can learn from others' experiences, not just those who we think have created an overnight success, but many who have stumbled, who have fallen, and gotten back up. And with the show, I bring you those people who have gone through difficult times and overcome. This show is about the windows of possibilities. And hopefully with the show, you can see a light coming through your own windows of possibilities. You can connect with me each week on my website at www.howshereallydoesit.com. And there's links for Facebook and Twitter, as well as you can sign up for the weekly newsletter. All live shows are available on my website the following week and also from iTunes for free. Amy Blockjoy has a PhD in nutrition sciences and has worked for the University of California for more than 30 years. Amy was the director for a $14 million program for poor families. And while at the UC Davis campus, Amy uncovered some embezzlement that led her down a road to becoming a whistleblower. Amy is here today to discuss her journey. Amy, hello and welcome.
Hello, and thank you. I'm honored to be on your show today.
I really appreciate this. This is, Amy, this is a really important topic. You know, I've gone through my own personal workplace hostility, being told that being a woman and with a family that I couldn't do my job as a coach, and how could I possibly do it because I didn't have a stay-at-home wife as my colleagues did. And you had a different situation because you had found embezzlement under this grant that you were running. Can you tell us a little bit about your background to your story?
Sure. I am a, and actually I want to start by saying I'm still employed as a faculty member at UC Davis. I got my PhD at Berkeley in 1979, and my interest has always been in the fighting of poverty, low-income families throughout California. And most of what I've done is to secure funding to make that practical. So I started a program in the 90s. I was transferred from Berkeley to Davis around that time and got a grant from the USDA to work on improving the self-sufficiency and diet-related health of low-income families throughout California. So we got $1 million that first year in the 90s, and the program grew and grew till it became a $14 million program. And it was a passion of mine to help people. I consider myself a compassionate individual, and I really wanted to use my background in poverty research to do something practical and to help people in California.
And so here you are running this grant, helping people, and then you came across, was it first the DVD purchase, the DVD camcorder purchase?
Well, you know, it's interesting. What happened initially was I was in the office, and I had left a report that I had been working on at home, and so I asked my budget person to get me the file copy from the files, and so I could work on it. And I noticed that the copy that she gave me had a different budget. In fact, the amount had been increased by $150,000. And I thought, oh, that's really weird. So I went up to the chairman of my department and said, hey, look, there seems to be a mistake here. And he kind of waved his hand and said, no big deal, it's math error, just get it fixed. So I went back to the budget person, and she seemed very contrite and upset that, you know, she responded appropriately, saying, I'll fix it. But there was this unease, discomfort about this. So after she went home, I went to the files to actually look around a bit and discovered they were all locked. And that really alarmed me. Well, you know, how come as the director of the program, I can't even get into the files of the program? So the next morning, she again very appropriately said, well, you know, this is a federal program. People walk away with files. You know, I don't trust that the program can be maintained as a secure program unless they're locked up and here's the key. And however, I noticed when I went to the files that she was very, very nervous, pacing around in her office, which happened to be kind of next to the files. So, and I'll tell you, the file room was very, very large, 20, 30 metal cabinets, each one having six drawers of 7 years' worth of federal documents. But it didn't take more than 5 minutes for me to find a file that had a big red flag. It was a purchase order that I hadn't approved. It was for an item that I didn't recognize. In fact, it was kind of disguised. It just said a Canon Optura, whatever that was. And it had my budget person approving, certifying, and written in her handwriting, pick up from vendor. Now, I didn't say anything. I made a copy of it. I put it back in the files, and then I thought, well, I'm going to find out about this this item. What is this Canon Optura? So I called the store. It was Fry's Electronics, and they told me it was a DVD camcorder. And this is an item that we do not purchase for the program because we don't make DVDs. We buy already made educational DVDs. And this camcorder was very, very pricey. And then, you know, the question was, what do I do? Mm-hmm. So do you want to know what I did?
Yes.
Okay. Feel free to interrupt me. But so I stared at that item. I wrote down all the possible scenarios I could imagine, you know, that maybe this was a special purchase. You know, I really wanted to not see that this was embezzlement. Then I decided to have a meeting with the employee and with the chair of the department. And then I decided that I would just confront her and, you know, ask for an explanation. And so I prepared myself for that meeting, and during that meeting, she said that she had bought it. And in fact, the question I asked, I decided that if I ask her, did you buy this camcorder, you know, and it's a personal expense mm-hmm. for yourself, which is the definition of embezzlement, that she would probably deny it. So I decided to ask her where it was. I actually wrote up what I was going to say to her. I gave a copy to her and to my boss, and I read it out loud to them. I made it short so that she couldn't think of find a way to wiggle out of this. And the only question I asked her is, where is it? And her answer was, it's in my garage. Now, I was so amazed that she confessed mm-hmm. that she had it. Funny thing that happened after that was the other person in the room said, well, is it still in the box? Which I thought was a very interesting question, because I had actually heard that she had been using a DVD camcorder to go to her son's basketball games and film them, and mm-hmm. I assumed that that was the same DVD camcorder. So on her way out of the meeting, in fact, she didn't seem too upset. She maintained good poise, and when she left, I asked her on her way out, is this the same camcorder you were using to film your son's basketball games? And she said yes.
Oh.
So, you know, So actually, the answer to the question in my own mind was that, yes, it is embezzlement. Then the next question is, what do we do about it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I thought my boss would step in and, you know, say, this is what we have to do.
Now, when he asked if it was still in the box, what did she say?
She said yes.
She said it was still in the box, but then she later admitted to you of using it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and in fact, frankly, she didn't say a lot during the meeting. But, and then actually he he actually kind of was very, very upset, in a stupor, kind of, and said something like, well, we know, and the embezzler's name is in the public domain, so I'm going to just say her name. We know Beverly is an honest person. We know she'll either return the item or pay the university back.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she also nodded to that. So she actually didn't say a lot, frankly. She nodded. She said yes. And basically, that was it.
And that was the first unraveling. And it sounds like it what made you finally make the whistleblower complaint? Why did you finally file that?
Well, I knew the policy that when you find wrongdoing, you report it. And the policy is that you report it to your supervisor. And I had done that. And it seemed to stop. I had a couple conversations about it and was given the idea it was going to be handled internally. I didn't actually feel comfortable with that. But I thought, well, if that's the way it's done, then, who am I to question it? Although I kept having this nagging feeling and discomfort, in which actually I recommend when people have this is they really pay attention to it. This is a very important point, that when you have this feeling that there's something that's bothering you more than it should, and you're thinking about it too much, then it really is something you need to do something about. So I, what I tend to do, and having worked at the university for 30 years, is I document everything. So I kept writing emails to try to get this discomfort that I was feeling taken care of. And so my emails would ask to be reported somewhere. I would write letters. My letters ended up in the files. The chairperson said, everything's okay. It's no big deal. This happens all the time at Davis. I want to clarify this right now, that it doesn't happen all the time at Davis. That is actually a red flag when someone tells you that. When someone says no big deal, happens all the time, that is a big red flag. It does not happen all the time. So I went to the vice chair, he seemed very appropriately upset. I gave him all the information I had, including two letters I had written about the incident. And he gave me the impression he was going to report it. And when I would ask again, I would get messages like, oh, the wheels of the university turn very slowly. It's my job. I'll report it. And then after, in fact, the employee behaved very contrite. She apologized. She wrote a letter that took responsibility. She gave me a check made out to the UC Regents. However, I never got to cash the check, and that increased my nervousness, because she would say, well, I don't have enough money to pay for it now. Can you hold it? And I thought it would be much worse if that check bounced. So I held on to it. Eventually, 3 or 4 months later, in June, she found the funds after I actually wrote another letter for the file. I wrote a letter to her, and it just ended up in the file, calling it embezzlement, wrongdoing. And she did say the check was okay, and I did cash it and did all the paperwork. And then things seemed to become more chaotic.
Amy,
can you
speak up a little louder?
Oh, okay, sorry.
There you go.
Things became chaotic. She started giving me misinformation about meetings. I would go to a meeting in Sacramento that wasn't there. The date was changed. All sorts of things were happening, and she seemed very angry at me. Now, initially, I thought, well, of course, someone would be angry. You catch them in doing some wrongdoing, and it didn't surprise me she'd be angry, but it got a little out of control, because she started getting angry at other people and got into fights, and then I relieved her of all her supervisory duties. Now, all along, she was she was her authority to purchase things was taken away. I do not know who actually gave her the authority to purchase things. I hadn't, but somehow she was managing to purchase things at Fry's Electronics. The minute I took her off of, removed her from being a supervisor, another staff member told me about travel fraud. Now, I'm going to say, told me an allegation of travel fraud. I did an audit at the university travel department accounts management, the accounts department at UC Davis, and sure enough, those trips looked like they were falsified. And then I went to the vice chair, who actually was now the chair, and said, you know, we have to do something today. We can't wait another minute. You have to call the dean's office today. It was Friday, August 24th, mm-hmm. 2006. And he says, well, this, you know, it's late in the afternoon. It's a Friday. We have to wait till next week. And that's when I went home, I just said, I can't handle this anymore. And I wrote a whistleblower report. I went on the internet, got the forms. There's a form where you sign that, you know, says that you, it's a good faith report, and, you know, it's a very short form. And then there's a sign to protect you from retaliation. I wrote up two pages about, and I included the documentation, and then I mailed it to the chancellor, the provost's office, the dean's office, human resources, to the chair, the vice chair, some other people, and I figured it's got to reach someone who will do something. And then I felt a huge relief. It was only momentarily though, that relief.
Did you feel you were going to be protected because of the whistleblower statement?
I did. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, you know, I had read about whistleblowers, and I knew that typically they lose their jobs, they typically leave the organization, that retaliation is very common. But I thought, with my background in public service, my 30-year career, you know, I had a clean record. I was an academic. I was on the faculty. You know, I was a director of a program. And I didn't do an anonymous whistleblower report. I signed it with my name. I said, this is not anonymous. I just felt, as director, that was my responsibility. And I just thought, I just have to let people know that this happened. And someone needs to take care of it.
Amy, did you have tenure?
Well, I'm in a position that is, it's a non-Senate position, academic position.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I don't know what tenure means. My job title is specialist.
Okay. So it wasn't that you felt you had tenure to protect your position?
No, I never really worried about that. It, you know, for me, the question was funding source. You know, someone has to pay your salary.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the program was paying my salary.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, it was possible that my job would be in jeopardy, but it was not on my mind. The important thing was that, you know, money was being stolen, and, you know, this needed to be taken care of. Actually, I even believed that the university would thank me for what I was doing. This was my thinking, was that this was the honorable and the right thing to do, and that I would be thanked for doing it.
Well, and that makes a lot of sense, because it would be a disgrace for the university to show that they have federal funds that are being embezzled, which can put a threat on all the research money that comes to the university. Tell me where I'm wrong.
No, you're absolutely right. Yes, this was exactly how I was thinking.
So you would think that the university would want to be on top of this and say, oh my goodness, let's take care of this. But that's not how it happened in your situation.
No, in fact, there was all sorts of things I didn't know about. And this is why, you know, I think writing this book was really important. That, you know, at the time, I didn't know that there was potentially a cover-up.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose if I had thought about it a little more deeply, I might have been able to figure that out. But at the time, it seemed like it was one rogue employee who probably thought she should have gotten more money for what she was doing. You know, I really don't understand the motivation behind the embezzlement, but I just thought it was one rogue employee working alone.
And so was the cover-up, was that because that there were funds that were being steered to other people and other department and other for other research? Is that what part of the cover-up was?
You know, I'm not really sure what was going on. All I have is the information that I uncovered, and I, you know, have documents about, and the internal auditing report indicated that that Beverly had been given authority to purchase things, and that a lot of the documents that they gave to me to review didn't have my signature on them. They had other people's, and there were several other people who signed off on some of these purchases. Her travel was approved by the chair of the department. They were trips all over California. She was receiving about $1,000 a month when she was actually sitting at her desk in Davis.
So
none of the travel was approved by me. I didn't even know that she was traveling or even getting reimbursement for travel. And, you know, this is one of the loopholes that Davis has now fixed, that the person who approves travel should know whether the person is traveling, should be the supervisor. Now, of course, the chair of the department probably has to sign the final approval for reimbursement, but there needs to be someone that says, yes, this person did travel, and I'm the supervisor of this person. That step was not taken in this case.
And when you first did this whistleblower complaint, I mean, it was just about 5 years ago, August of 06.
Yes.
How much money did you think was part of this embezzlement that was going on?
I think my report said $22,000. I think I had calculated 18 months of $1,000 a month travel fraud, and then the DVD camcorder, which was $1,400.
And then I've seen different numbers, so I'm not sure how much in the end. How much in the end did the auditors figure out was embezzled?
The embezzler, it was $168,000, the total amount, over about 10 years.
And then why did I see a number that for $2.3 million?
That is the number. Now, you know, it's like pulling a string. You know, you find a thread in your sweater and you kind of pull on it and suddenly everything unravels.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is what happened with this investigation. It wasn't just embezzlement. There were other things going on. There were a category called misappropriation, and that is when funds are spent on a grant for something that the grant did not intend it to be spent on. So it's not for personal gain. Embezzlement is about personal gain, whereas misappropriation is spending for items that were not intended to be spent on by the rules of the funding agency. So there were a lot of purchases made for the department that I did not approve, and that I think ended up being about $600,000. And also, they were not appropriate based on the rules of the program funds. So the program funds were for educating low-income families about nutrition and health.
Okay. So, because one of the questions would be is that, do you think that there's a certain dollar amount a whistleblower, when one decides to file a whistleblower complaint, to make the complaint worthy to an organization or to the university?
Well, I think as an individual, you know, if they can actually figure out the amount, but I think most of the time the person needs to make a good faith report to their supervisor. In fact, what I recommend people do is they need to know the organization's policies, the organization's mandate, and they need to follow the policy, you know, almost to the letter, to avoid getting into the pitfalls of you know, what happens in order to protect themselves. So they also need to know their rights. Now, most programs and organizations and institutions have a whistleblower policy. They have a process. They have an anonymous process, and they also have a law against retaliating for making a disclosed report, which is a whistleblower report. And it's good for people to know that. Now, you know, they don't. The university or other organizations doesn't want the employee to investigate, and they don't want people to get themselves in trouble. So, you know, I don't know what the dollar amount is. It actually probably is quite low, the threshold on when something becomes against the law. You know, I don't know if it's $20 or if it's $500, but it's you know, it's not millions.
Mm-hmm.
However, the organization has particular rules on how they want to do an investigation. So, but the other important thing for employees to know is to document. So, for example, if you find something that you think is a wrongdoing or misuse of funds, you know, write it down for yourself and write all the things that are going around in your head that make you think it's a wrongdoing. Now, it could be that there's a reasonable explanation and maybe it isn't wrongdoing. And then also try to find a person in the organization that you trust. Now, hopefully that person is your supervisor, and hopefully you can have a confidential discussion with the person and pass on the information. What I also recommend is after you do that, you know, tell the person it's confidential and then write up an email or a letter and document, you know, I met with you on this day to discuss a confidential matter and, you know, thank you for meeting with me. You don't have to write the confidential matter, but you just need to document that you did report it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and how do you know who you trust? Because you saw people that you'd been lifelong colleagues with, who had gone to your wedding, who turned on you. So how does one learn who they can trust in a situation like this?
Well, that's a really important question. Hopefully, you know, I'm hoping that my particular case is unique in that it doesn't happen that frequently, and I think it is. I think that's generally true. I think most of I've been doing a survey on whistleblowing policies in other institutions, and most of what I've heard is not as complex as this particular case is. So to find out who you trust, word of mouth, you know, and also, like I said, the first person hopefully will be your supervisor, because that most policies will say that you need to report this to your supervisor. If you feel your supervisor might not give you the response you want, then I think you still need to talk to your supervisor, but you need to pay attention to the response you get. And if you don't get a response that says, yes, I'll take care of it, and you don't get the right sort of feeling that this will be handled, then perhaps you need to find someone else in the organization.
This is Corinne Motokaitis, and my guest today is Amy Block. She is a scientist, educator, and also author of Whistleblower. And we're talking about her experiences as a whistleblower at UC Davis. So, Amy, because one of the things is that as I talk with people about their workplace, and when especially working for larger organizations, and you know, being a Davis member, I have a lot of friends who work for the university or the med center. And actually, this conversation of whistleblowing came up last week with a friend of mine, where it's a hostile work environment, right? And just like you had experienced with Beverly, where she started changing the meetings for not letting you know, this has happened with a friend of mine, that the meetings times have been changed so that she couldn't attend. and the other stuff happening. And she looks at that whistleblower poster that's hanging up in her office, and her direct comment was to me was, there's no way we're being harassed. And if you stand, she said, what I have learned working at the university is that when you stand up for people who, you know, and you don't just be nice and go along, but you stand up in a polite manner, people don't like you and you get shoved aside. And eventually you're not asked to go to meetings, or the meetings are changed to times that you can't make it as a supervisor. And she felt that, you know, if she were to do a whistleblower complaint about a hostile work environment, that she would not be protected, and she would be the one that ultimately paid the price. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, that's a really, really difficult issue, and I know a lot of people are suffering with that same sort of worry. The one thing about my case was it had to do with embezzlement and fraud, which mm-hmm. you can clearly document. You can look at financial records. Workplace hostility is really, really difficult to prove. And yes, if you blow the whistle, it's likely not to get people to behave better. I'm not really sure what the answer is. I think you know what the policies tell you to do. If you're in a union, you're supposed to talk to your union representative. If you're in a an academic like me, you're supposed to talk to your supervisor. You're supposed to go to human resources. A lot of changes need to be made to resolve this.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I recommend is to start documenting, because typically when people want you to leave, if you're asking questions and you're making people uncomfortable, at some point a mistake will be made, and maybe it'll be something that you can document. But it's a very difficult issue to find good evidence about workplace hostility.
Mm-hmm.
But pay attention, write down things, send emails, and document. Sometimes I would even send emails to myself, just so that I have a date stamped record of what happened and how I felt about it. There are resources on the campus for people to get assistance. What you want to do is find someone who is kind of independent from management, especially if you feel management is creating the hostility. Everyone is stressed these days with budget problems, so find someone that you trust that has some authority, and see if you can get them to give you guidance.
Mm-hmm. Well, it just seems from my own experience, and then just talking with other people and reading your book, it seems like the university has what they put up on their website, what they pass out in these employee handouts, right? Retaliation is not allowed.
Yes.
But then you are a direct recipient of retaliation.
Yes, yes. And if you, in my case, every time someone did something that I thought was retaliation or intimidation or threatening, I would write it up and send it to the person who was in charge of the whistleblowing program. It's called the locally designated official.
Mm-hmm.
And the person received probably hundreds of emails from me. And I'm not exaggerating. I wrote a lot of emails, and I documented everything. I got very good at actually explaining what was going on. But the first probably 90 of them, I would get a response saying, I'm sorry this is happening to you, but this is not considered retaliation because you filed a whistleblower report. So, the law is very complicated. you actually have to show that the retaliation is based on the fact you you made a confidential disclosure, and it has to go back to the person who you whistleblowed on. So, but you know, as time went on, things got more tense. It wasn't like I didn't tell people not to leave me out of meetings. I was very, very vocal, although I did it in writing rather than vocal. That's the other thing. Writing is more helpful because in the end, when you want to show what happened, you can print an email, or you have a conversation with someone, unless you took notes and the person agreed to what happened, you know, you don't have the documentation. Now, what I do suggest, if you have a conversation with someone you don't think it goes well, the next day or the same day, you know, send an email. You know, this is what we talked about. This is what happened. This is what you said. This is what I said. You know, there's a lot of writing involved, but it's a way to keep your head on straight. And frankly, I found it therapeutic to write down everything that happened.
It seems like to do this, you have to be very organized and very meticulous.
Yes.
And is that in the end what allowed you not to lose your job, I guess, was that you had so much documentation and you were willing to spend a whole summer putting together a 300-page document to protect yourself?
Yes. Well, you know, I was the subject of an investigation 3 times during the whole process. In fact, the first thing that happened to me after I filed the whistleblower report, you know, and you know, I said I mailed mine. Well, it turns out when I put the employee on investigatory leave, she drove over to the auditor's office and walked in and said, "I'm here to announce a crime," and she filed a whistleblower report against me. So, so I was actually served at my home, you know, a few days. It was actually Labor Day weekend, 2006. Served at my home in Kensington with the strangest letter I've ever read. It didn't tell me what I was accused of. It just said that I could go to work, I could sit in my office, I couldn't interact with my staff, and I couldn't go into the files.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, what I did. I had many friends who were attorneys, and I called one of them and said, you know, I want to read you this letter, so maybe you could explain. Maybe it's in a, you know, legal language, and that's why I'm not understanding it. And the minute I said I'm a whistleblower, this friend of mine said, "Oh, I can't talk to you. You have to have a special attorney as a whistleblower."
Oh, really?
Yes. Well, that's what I was told. So I. So I thought, well, I'll just have to do this alone. So I went to meet with the auditors, and, you know, they explained to me the process. And in fact, you know, I wanna actually say that the retaliation was done by a group of people. It's not a large group of people. A lot of the people were confused, misinformed, had heard gossip. Not that I want to give an excuse to them, but this is what happens when you're a whistleblower. People just, for some unconscious reason, they are believing something that may not be true. Davis did right by me. They hired an investigator. They looked into my retaliation complaint very thoroughly, very rigorously. And I, in the end, it was substantiated, and I feel that they did a very good job. The one thing that's very painful for anyone who wants to blow the whistle is the length of time it takes. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it can take less than 5 years. Probably 3 to 4 would be a normal amount of time that an investigation like this could take. it's a long, long time to have to hold your head up high and ignore what people are saying about you, ignore the hurt, and actually the most cruel part of the gossip is that people, you know, say that you're mentally ill. This is a vicious way of stigmatizing someone, but it's very, very effective. It keeps people away from you.
This is Corinne Motokaitis, and you're listening to How She Really Does It. My guest today is scientist, educator, and author Amy Blockjoy, and her book is Whistleblower. So, Amy, the Enterprise had reported a settlement with you and the university, and in your book, you never had mentioned hiring an attorney, but there was a forward from your attorney. So what stage did you go into the process of working with an attorney?
Actually, thank you for asking. I did not actually have my attorney available to talk to the university until after the book was written. He reviewed a few things for me and kind of was in the shadows, as I say, because I wanted to keep lines of communication open. I did not want to sue the university. I wanted to, my biggest priority was to keep my job. I love Davis. I love working at Davis. It's a great place to work. It's a great place to study. The students are wonderful. And so I didn't really want to have an attorney. I wanted to show that you could tell the truth and be okay just simply because the truth can get you through this. Well, when I filed a complaint, I retained an attorney to review it, and he was kept in the shadows until I was, you know, the university made an arrangement to settle with me, but it took another year, and that's when I said, please, I'd like you to meet my attorney. So that's when he came out. I'd already written the book by then.
So did they, because it's one of the settlements was your salaries and benefits for 2008 to 2011. So were you not paid during that time period?
Oh, no, I was paid the entire time. And actually, the settlement goes to 2013. So
was that just to say how much money you were to be paid? Like what your salary was? Because you were already paid. So I'm a little confused about that.
Well, this was the issue for me. As long as I retained my role as director, I was paid by the program I was directing, this food stamp nutrition program. And so once I was going to step down, the question was who was going to pay my salary. So I held on to being director and worked as hard as I could to, you know, keep the program going and keep my job as director as long as I could. When I ended up going to the hospital with an irregular heartbeat, I figured that it would be probably best for the program for me not to continue. That's when the alarm went off in my own head that, oh, maybe this is too stressful. You know, I just thought working as hard as I could do it. And then with the irregular heartbeat, I thought, well, this is actually way too stressful. And at the same time, the retaliation complaint had been investigated and substantiated, and that's when a memorandum of understanding was written with the dean's office to that they would pay my salary for, I think it was 4 or 5 years, and then the last year would be paid by the provost office.
Okay. So it was about making sure that there was a funding source from the university.
Okay.
And so, Amy, knowing what you know, going through these last 5 years, would you do it all over again?
Absolutely, in a heartbeat.
Why?
Well, because first, I sleep really well at night. and I believe that, in fact, I feel that other people who were in my shoes would do the same thing. I strongly believe that that you can't turn your back on fraud, you can't turn your back on embezzlement. And, you know, even if people don't like it, even if it ends up in the newspaper, I think we're all going to be better off if we deal with it, take care of it, fix the problems, and then move on.
And but doesn't it take a tremendous amount of courage?
You know, I people have asked me that. It didn't feel like courage. It just felt like that I had to do it. It was just the right thing to do. And I believe that other people would have the same response. I don't think I'm different in that respect. I think people, there's a lot of people with integrity at Davis. I think people in my shoes would have said, you know, we have to fix this. It can't go on. And, you know, everything has to be reviewed and taken care of.
It
sounds like you have some.
I guess I have a different experience over at the university because some people who, I would call them rabble rousers, you know, who said that this is going against university policy. This is, you know, and this was brought up. And I had other friends who are faculty saying that was not handled appropriate, or this faculty person was, that wasn't the right thing to do. And then a friend of mine just last week had said something about a vice chancellor, and they said, well, really to get to those places, you know, you really need to know how to manage upward. So there's some cynicism, I guess, that I have experienced. And one of the things I appreciate about you is that you took a stand and you did what was right, right? You have a program that's supposed to feed poor families, and money was being diverted elsewhere. And you stood up for those families. And sometimes I feel like I see people and they just go, well, you know what? I have to keep my job. So I just need to be quiet.
I totally think that I understand that. Until the protections are better, I actually recommend people, if they want to report, they do it anonymously.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, I was director of the program.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was a 30-year employee. I didn't think this would happen to me. And even knowing now that it did, I think I would do it better the next time. I know now how to document things. And I can understand that people wouldn't want to, but sometimes the issue is so compelling that you just have to.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to hold my head up high. I wanted, at the end of the day, to say to myself, this was an important thing to do, and I had to do it. And hope for the best.
Maybe this comes from your Berkeley roots of going to Cal.
It probably does.
No, and I think it's really inspiring because I have stood up in my own experience, and it is hard. It can be very isolating socially, you know, because for the most part, I think most people have an ingrained feeling of wanting to be well-liked, right?
Oh, and absolutely. Now, remember, in my case, this is embezzlement and fraud. I think that makes it different than most issues that people are contemplating. This one can be proved without, you know, with evidence. So,
well, and if you find out about it and don't know and don't do anything, then aren't you also participating in embezzlement because you're not reporting it?
Yes. I mean, that's the other thing, and I think the guilt. In fact, I used to wake up feeling guilty that I missed something. You know, every day in the past. Well, not in the past year, but in the past 4 years before that, I would wake up saying, how did I miss this? I would go through it in my head over and over again. You know, was there something I didn't see? Yeah, no. Guilt has that way of getting you to take action.
No, I think the whole thing's fascinating. And then one of the other things is that the relationships in the book, which I think is a must read for people, is how Beverly was manipulating people, telling, you know, trying to isolate you from other staff members that she could be more in control of stuff. And it's interesting when you start to look into stuff like this about how people do this, whether it's a form of bullying or manipulation that they do to carry on, I guess, their own agenda. And that was extremely fascinating that happened. Do you feel that she had more protection in this than you did or others?
She did, yes, yes. And, that was the part that I didn't know about. Now, if I had known that, I don't know if I would have done anything differently. I probably would have done things differently because the person who was protecting her was a very powerful person and my boss.
Mm-hmm.
So, that made it possible for this to go on for longer. And there were probably a lot of people that knew about it but were too afraid, first of all, because, another person who had reported it ended up leaving and just disappearing. They didn't think anything would be done. And, you know, I can understand, and that's why I'm talking about this, because I think the culture of an organization needs to change. It needs to pay attention to relationships between, higher management and staff. It needs to really be sure that people aren't afraid, don't feel intimidated, and that the workplace is one of being productive. And the bullying has to stop.
Well, it would be in line with their principles of community at UC Davis.
Yes. Oh, the principles of community are beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, and there are so many places at Davis where things are going really well. So, you know, I want to remind the audience that, you know, Davis is a great institution, and they did do right by me. It just took a long time, and being a whistleblower, that's part of the consequences.
Well, Amy, I really appreciate you coming on the radio show today. Thank you.
I've been honored to be talking with you about this. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is Corinne Motokaitis, and you've been listening to How She Really Does It. My guest today is Amy Block Joy. She's a scientist, educator, and author of her book, Whistleblower.
Early morning, fog is lifting. She's in a rowboat on a lake. She is dreaming, she is drifting. Never been so wide awake. Captured in the moment by the beauty all around her. There's nowhere else that she would rather be. And Virginia looks up. She says this could be my day. And she thinks a thought of thanks for all the things that come her way. And some say she's a dreamer, and some call her a fool. But before you even blink your eyes, Virginia saves her money, grabs her backpack, hops a jetpack.